Today on the Rights and Wrongs podcast, I'm joined by the host of the Open Windows Culture podcast, J. Kevin Powell. We will be talking about systemic racism in financial institutions, in which he has focused his entire first season on speaking on from multiple perspectives. We will also be speaking about what the difference between systemic and systematic racism is, and racism or race versus culture, along with a few other issues in these areas. Today's episode is a little bit longer than usual. However, it's packed full of informative information and a really enjoyable discussion that we had, and I hope you enjoyed as well. Welcome to the Rights and Wrongs podcast, the podcast to talk about rights, privileges, and misconceptions. Today, I am joined by J. Kevin Powell of the Open Windows Culture podcast. I will let him introduce himself because today's episode, we're going to be talking about systemic racism in financial institutions. Thanks for joining us, Kevin.
Thanks for having me, and hello, good people out there. Once again, it's Kevin Powell. I am with Open Windows Culture, and the reason it's called Open Windows Culture is from developing and working in the area of diversity and culture from the mid-90s, I've learned that there are a couple of things that happen when people are looking to grow. And so one of those things is you first have to acknowledge that you need to open or draw your curtains, as we call it, open your windows. From there, you have to unlock the latch, and then you have to actually open the window. And we'll get into that a little bit more, but I run through that because you need to understand that as I am a black guy from Baltimore who started doing diversity and culture training in the early 90s, that I do not limit myself to talking about racial issues as much as I consider myself a unity specialist, with the idea of understanding that cultures everywhere have strengths and weaknesses that we need to bring together and come together so we can learn how to become better people as a whole. So thanks for having me here. I'm looking forward to jumping into this and just the many ways I'm expecting us to end up going today.
Well, it's a very challenging topic. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure when it's going to come out, but I was also a guest on your podcast for talking about this exact issue through a veteran perspective in the VA. And this is going to be more of a summary view. If you enjoy talking about this topic, which is very fascinating, I suggest hopping over to Open Windows Culture when you start publishing more episodes, because I know you're just getting into the backlog now before you push out.
Yep.
And because this is a very challenging thing, and I like the way that you're doing it, where I only spend an episode on a specific issue, you're spending an entire season trying to hit it from every angle possible. And I think that's the right way to handle it. But one thing both of our podcasts have a mission for is making sure terms are understood, defining something, as we've kind of gone into on your episode, was making sure you're academically correct over politically correct, because emotion's important, but we're not trying to go out of our way to hurt someone. But if we're not using the same language, we might as well not be speaking. And that's kind
of pretty much.
So I want us to open up with a common thing we do here on Rights and Wrongs is there any buzzwords or phrases that when it comes to the idea of financial institutions or anything around that you just, in this issue of systemic racism, that you just want to address because people are misusing them or like they just don't know what they are?
Yeah, and I'm going to give you two. I'm going to give you two because I know one is not technically a buzzword for culture and diversity, but it is a buzzword still in what I do. And when I'm doing a training, when I'm working with a group and we're talking about culture, we're talking about coming together, and the response that always pops up that irks me like crazy is when somebody says, shouldn't this be organic? And the reason I throw organic out there as a buzzword is I like to use the example of pick anything organic that you can think of. It can be a flower, it can be an animal, it can be a cell. I don't care what you can think of organic. If you pick out something that is organic and you look closely enough at it, what it goes through is a process, a deliberate process that happens so quickly, so efficiently that you don't see it. The flower goes through a process. A cell goes through a process. A dog goes through a process. And because the process happens super efficiently, it doesn't mean it just happened by mistake. And so we tend to use organic as in happened by mistake. So when we talk about cultural issues and things happening organically, people tend to use organic as in, shouldn't it just happen naturally and slowly? Well, there's nothing in nature that doesn't happen through a deliberate process. And so we confuse organic for being happenstance when organic is really doing a process so efficiently that you don't understand that it is a process. It's creating a deliberate process. We don't think that when we use organic. And so that bugs me like terrible. And I usually end up in some diatribe in the middle of a room at some point, anytime that pops up. The second one is microaggressions. And that one's a new one to my list. It's a buzzword that's out there. It's a buzzword that people like to use and like to say. And the only reason it really bothers me is because microaggression also kind of aligns to me with the Freudian concept of just your unconscious conflict, that there is something deep inside you and you just haven't dealt with it before. And because you haven't looked at it and haven't dealt with it, then it boils up, as I like to think about it, your unconscious conflict boils up to your subconscious. Then your subconscious boils up into your conscious. And that's where you have this progress of conflict that turns into some actual outward expression. And so we use microaggressions as an explanation for why we do and say certain things without understanding why we do or say certain things. And we like to use microaggression as also an excuse as to not to search for why we do certain things. Because ultimately, we have to get to the intent. We have to get to the core and the base of where everything came from so that we can do something about that so it doesn't happen again. And sometimes a term like microaggression allows us, and it's the same issue with organic, or organic allows us to throw out the term and ignore the fact that we need to work to improve the reason that the term is there in the first place.
No, I really like that you talk about that. And it just, it popped in my head where I didn't make a connection earlier when we were talking about this, how you're talking about organic, where a lot of people like to talk about things that are happening in the current political market, where everyone goes, oh, let the free market figure it out. Like, let it organically solve itself.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's exactly. Just, but the first problem is, like, in the United States, we don't have a free market.
Right.
So
exactly.
So, no, it's interesting when we're talking about this. It's like, well, let the free market figure out the systemic racism or the systematic racism, which is also something that real quickly when we're talking about this, systematic and systemic is basically a root cause, which may be an underlying or the roots from a systematic racism thing that was before. Yep. But systematic's when the policy is going out directly after a demographic or a person or personnel. Mm-hmm. That's systematic. Like think of the Terminator coming after you. That's systematic. Systemic is someone overlooked a policy or overlooked not getting rid of a policy that affects someone that's usually because it's other than themselves and it's other than white middle class or white upper class because they're like, they don't think of policies. Oh, this policy doesn't affect anyone because it doesn't affect me and everyone's like me. And I'm not saying they're being arrogant in that film. They're being ignorant and there is a difference there too. It's just like, you don't know what you don't know.
Yeah, I mean, it falls into that area of being myopic. Like, for example, I went into the gym the other day here and
I missed the gym.
The gym manager. One day soon, you'll be able to go again. The manager was sitting there and he's saying, well, I don't think COVID-19 is a major issue because I don't know anybody who's had it and nobody here in this gym has gotten it from here. Well, that's a very myopic view. I mean, unless you're really, really that popular, you don't know even a sample size of the U.S. population, much less the state population, much less the world's population, to be able to say whether it's a real thing or not just because of your closed window of thought. And so that same issue pops into place when you're talking about making laws and making policies where you're like, oh, well, this law, this policy works great for the people I know. But the people you know isn't representative of everybody it affects.
Well, it's also interesting to use COVID-19 as an example of that because like COVID-19 is kind of one of those extreme cases where I'm fortunate to know a few people because I know like I have family members and friends that have family members that are nurses. So like they've caught it or they deal with people directly because where they work. And I have friends that are law enforcement and fire. So like they've caught it or know people because like that they're first responders. But if you're outside of that wheelhouse of people knowing like that, COVID-19 is one of those things. If you don't know anyone that caught it, that's good. Because if you probably knew someone that caught it, there's a good chance that you caught it and everyone else caught it from you. So it's like either you're in the center of or you're away from it. And it's one of those situations like I'm happy that they don't know anyone it because that means they're safer and their bubble and their circle is safer. Because it's the chances that you knowing someone that has it, great is the chance of you knowing more people to have it just because how viruses work. And strangely enough, I think that actually goes in a good segue when you talk about financial institution or racial systemic issues. Because if you're not in the communities or the areas where like the scars of redlining still exist and people...
Right.
I'm not going to go into that because if you don't know what redlining is, just look it up. Like that's like one of the few things if you Google it, it will tell you what redlining is.
That's like a starter point. You have to know what redlining is.
But like the truth is if you've never seen it, then you're going to not believe it exists. Like I'll be honest, I was pretty ignorant of redlining growing up in the Boston area because everyone, even though we're supposed to be very progressive, we're just naturally segregated by groups, but that's just kind of by choice, kind of not by choice. you really don't see redlining in the communities like where I was in, like the greater Boston area, until you get down to like the Brockton, far South Shore, the West. But you really noticed it when I was in the South. Like,
yeah,
the other side of the tracks literally means the other side of the tracks. Like, there is a clear definition of I'm in the white side of the town, I'm in the black side of town. And like, there is, and that's where you can really see the scars. And that's where a lot of this, when it comes to understanding with these groups, where you are, systemic racism, like in financial institutions, when you brought in, like approached me to be on the podcast about it, I never thought about it so much through, like, when you had me offer like veteran institutions. Like, I didn't really think about it until I sat down and like gave it 5 minutes of thought. And I'm like, wow, there's a thousand different ways this applies.
Yeah. But
because I've never had to think about it on for myself.
Yeah.
I just was ignorant about it just because it's never been something I had to think about.
And the wonderful part about our discussion was, even in the way you thought about it, brought in a different perspective. Because even eventually, you try to go into these without having too much of a closed thought of knowing where things are going to go. And so you throw it out there and you say, hey, this is the question I'm asking. Go with this where you go with it. And I'm here to learn because I want to learn. I want to learn too. So I come into this and I come into my podcast with the idea that I'm guiding a discussion and going through a series of topics, but it's not me trying to teach everybody. In fact, I use the word facilitate more than I use the word teach, because I want the process to be the process and to learn through it at the same time. And when we were talking about GI Bill and the effect of GI Bill, you focused a lot on private and public schooling and how those can target minorities and blacks in a way that, in order to get the capitalism, in order to get the funds and the profits out of the GI Bill, which is a way I hadn't even thought of. My mind process was like, okay, GI Bill, what did the Army do to create a problem? And I was thinking more internally to the entity of the Army and the military and the Marines and Navy and Air Force and Coast Guard, not to leave anybody out, Space Force. and I was thinking more internally than I was thinking externally. And so it just continually opened my eyes to the fact that we think of that system as being so closed and forgetting that you have this external element that is feeding into that systemic racism just as much as you do the internal element. And we can get blinded, or not blinded, we can put our, the blinders on and get so focused in one area that we miss some of the other, where other input comes in.
No, and it's very true, because like the problem is, like when you talk about a lot of things within the military, when it comes to racism still, we like to say that there's only one color in the Marine Corps and it's green. But you notice there's a difference, because it's like, because it's like when you have to try and describe someone, it's like, because the truth is every one of us are wearing the same outfit. And like, if you don't read the name on there, and it's just like, well, you can't be like, well, what did he look like? It's like, well, he was wearing camouflage, he had a clean haircut, wearing combat boots, and had a rifle. Okay, you just described everyone. So
That's everybody on the base.
So then you become very creative about like saying, oh, which one? Oh, the caramel Marine, the dark green Marine.
Really?
Because you try not to be like, because you're trying your very well to be it, but it is part of like identity and like trying to like, I didn't know. I just saw like a Marine. Well, what did he look like? And it's like, oh, okay, this is going to be a little bit difficult, but there is.
That's not going to get me any closer, but okay.
But you know, like racism and sexism still plays a lot of pull in it. There is a lot of trying to make sure all minorities and all groups and like genders are accounted for. Like, you do have a lot of that in the military, but it's so nuanced. Yeah. When you're talking about systemic, it's like, it's systemic based in the culture, which I find like that's very hard to say, because like now I'm trying to put myself in the picture of the people making these decisions,
right?
Which I don't want to ever do. Like, that's where, because that's not opinions on facts and theories and ideas, that's opinions on opinions based on opinions,
right,
of my own personal like experience. And it's like, the sad thing is my experience is my opinion of how I perceived something. So it's like, I try to avoid that when you're asking that question.
Yeah. Because
there is a lot of internal systemic issues in that, in a financial institution, like which units get like better. If you go back to like the Civil War,
definitely.
I'm pretty sure like the black units got worse.
They hand me down everything.
Yeah. And like, you saw the probably the same thing in World War I and World War II. They went to different boot camps. So like, there are things to look at, but that's just so well documented. And like, I feel like that's far, like it takes a part of our history.
Yeah.
But I don't think when you're talking about like institutions, like that you have to be aware of, like we have to be aware of this part of the history, but how much does that play into context for the situation right now compared to something else? Like, you have to do a weight of not ignore, but like what to put to aside as like a footnote.
And that's always one of those type of things that kind of leads me into areas with some people. You know, one of the ways I tend to classify myself or think about myself is I'm kind of the in-between guy, right? So if you're talking about an issue of, let's say you're just talking about an issue of hate or forgottenness or just isolating somebody, and you're talking about the person who's been hated against and isolated against, then you have a gap in a space that's there. And often where I end up being is the person who's standing in between the two, trying to meld the two together a little bit. And so what that means is, on some level, for example, I have to acknowledge that there were areas of racism, for example, that we started out with talking about, that there were areas of racism that were entirely deliberate, like entirely deliberate, meant to hold, as I think I was reading history on the Southern Bloc voting on FHA or no federal farm loan. And one of the phrases they were used to hold blacks in their place, you know, and so there's some of that deliberate intentionality there. But there is a level of ignorance there. And I have to be knowledgeable about that, because I don't think, even though it gets a negative connotation, I don't always consider, oftentimes I don't consider ignorance a bad word. We have a connotation of ignorance, but ignorance is a lack of class or knowledge, right? And we are all ignorant about something. And so we know that there are times there where there's been a rule, a law, a policy that's been put in place where the person putting it in place didn't understand the effect that it could have on a different person or a different culture. And so there was actually just a level of ignorance there that wasn't intentionally meant to harm, but did. And then there was a level of intentionality there that was meant to harm and did. And so we have to find out where the lines of those are. And then we have to be able to say to the person that was hurt, like, I know you were hurt. I know you were hurt by this action, but let's find the middle ground of where that is. Because in order for us to be able to move forward, and I am big on that. I don't like having discussions for the sake of having discussions. The way I say it is, it's 2021. We've had the discussion for hundreds of years now. It's time to move. So I don't want to have a discussion just because we have a discussion and we want to feel good about it. Oh, we've done something. We've had a discussion. That's not an action. So I want to find the middle ground, figure how we unify who we are, where we cross, where we think the same, and see if we can turn that into an actual action that changes something. And so when we're looking at the podcast, it's totally kind of what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to walk through different perspectives and get different sides of a perspective and then move that into an actual action.
No, it's fascinating how you talk about that, for it is true when you're looking at financial institutions, there are some that do very specific things that are perceived as racist. Mm-hmm. One thing that I was thinking about when you're talking about, I don't know why this popped in my head, but like I've been doing some research for another episode and I just find it very fascinating that there was a few, and I can't remember, I don't want to say the wrong firearm company just because I don't want to like give them some shade. Gotcha. I think it's between one or two, but there was a firearm company that literally put out when it said to its sales, to like the people selling these firearms, and they're talking like the 1860s and stuff, like cowboy era, do not sell to Indians. Like you cannot sell. And the thing that popped out to my mind about that is like, we're a country based off rights, not a country based off rules. Like our rules are based off rights.
Right.
You have the, like in an American thing is, if you own a business, you have the right to refuse service.
Yeah.
But it's kind of weird that the manufacturer is telling you who you have the right to refuse service to. And the other thing that like go back to, it's like, well, how does that apply back to financial services? It's like a bank had to, or someone had to back that factory and that manufacturer to invent this product.
Yeah.
And could you imagine a car company now going, oh, we're going to sell this car to dealers on the thing, but these dealers aren't allowed to sell these cars to any blonde woman.
Well, I even have one for you. Like, you don't even have to imagine it. Like when FHA was created, and we've talked about this, I think this popped up in the podcast talking about taxes. So we have one podcast talking about how taxes have created wealth gaps. And once the conversation that came up in there was when FHA was first created in, I believe it was 1993, but something like 1993 through 68, 73, somewhere in that time frame. The FHA was giving out loans. Now, the loans that were given out were, one, 98% to white families. They wouldn't give out a loan to a black family. When they did give out a loan to a black family, the loans were defined to certain areas. So that's when we get back to redlining. So FHA would give a black family a loan in a red line area, but not in the other colors, the orange, the blue, the green areas. And then once it was determined by law, like, wait a minute, this ain't legal. You can't say this. it was removed from FHA paperwork to do that. But what they still did was they FHA had manuals that they released to subdivisions. And in those manuals in the subdivisions, it basically said, do not allow people of other races. And I wish I could remember the words. But if you want to go back, check out that podcast. We'll get into it there. But it basically said, do not allow people from other races to move into your neighborhood. And that was actually written in print in the subdivision manuals before somebody said, oh, this isn't legal, you have to move it. So that's, we don't even have to imagine that. The FHA actually did that.
And the weird thing that I'm just trying to think about that is just imagine... it's going to sound like a weird tangent, but like that, yeah. If you think about like the Japanese internment camps where everyone like,
yeah,
was,
yeah,
forced to like, they were forced to, they, the government's like, you can't be here anymore. Go over here. Yeah. Then they foreclosed their businesses and homes. White people, yeah, bought them. And then you had a law like, oh, you can't have white, yes, people, like non-white people can't move here. Like, yes, that was their neighborhood.
Yes. They built yes. And then release them like, you're free, but all your stuff is gone and you can't go back to own your house, your business or anything.
And then they're going to be looking down at you. It's like, it's not my fault you're poor. Yes, it is.
Yes, it is. You put us over here. We were doing just fine. Just fine.
Oh, it, like that also reminds me so much of like when Watchmen came out a couple years ago and they talked about, yeah, the Tulsa riot. Because Watchmen is, yeah, a historical, like there's parts of it that aren't true. Like we don't have caped crusaders running around. Or if we do,
right,
we don't worship them. They just go to the padded cell and like you do find Jerry, you go over there. We don't accept
here's a code for you.
But it was amazing how many Americans thought that the Tulsa riots was part of the historical like alternate history of the show. And it's like, no, that actually happened. Like,
yeah,
but it is, yeah, kind of strange because it's something so out there of American history that it's like I was kind of taught it. And like it was, I remember being taught about it, but it was like a brief summary like during Black History Month one point,
yeah,
where we're talking about the Tulsa riots real quickly. But then it's just like, yeah, but this happened. But then the civil rights happened and we're all good and everyone's happy donkey dory. And then now it's 2010 and we have a Black president. Like, right, that was just kind of the...
we're good now. No. So yeah, that said, one of the things I strongly advocate for is understanding that history, your history books are wrong. Like, yeah, history books are wrong because history books are written by the victor. And I've actually written a book and released that late last year. And it's Open Windows Cultures, the Christian's Guide. And the idea is how to take these practical tools and actually use it where you are. And one of the things I reference in there, if do you remember that Indiana Jones, and I can't remember Last Crusade, I think it was, but they were in Nazi territory and they were doing the book burning.
Yeah.
And I referenced that theme because I referenced when I was young, I saw the scene and didn't necessarily connect to it. Like, oh, they're burning books. And then as I got older, I realized, oh, they're burning their history, their point of view, their culture, who they are as people, their heroes, their biographies. You know, you're realizing that all this stuff is being burned and it's all being encapsulated in this book, and that the victors at that moment, Nazi Germany at that moment, they're defining what the story is from that point forward. And so when you look at a book, no matter how much a person wants to be unbiased, there's still bias, no matter how much you want to be in bias. You know, no matter how hard you try, you still come with your perspective, your lens, and you're always confined by those. Even as you expand them, you're still confined by your expanded lens. And so when you're looking at history and trying to understand a subject matter, you have to look at it from different perspectives. You have to look at it from different views and from different people. So even on the podcast, when we're doing systemic racism in financial services, we're actually going to launch February 1st. Since that issue is going in line with racism, we're going to actually launch it with Black History Month. But I am still going to advocate with that you go to somebody else's podcast and listen, that you go to other people's books and listen. Because the thing is, I can try and be as broad and as comprehensive as I want to be from my perspective, but it's still going to be my perspective. I can't be entirely broad. So you have to inform yourself. Never stop at the first thing you see, and definitely never stop at the thing or the book or the source that specifically it reinforces exactly what you thought either.
No, it's so true. When people talk, trying to ask me, and like some people, like when they ask me to come on their podcast as like guests and stuff, they're like, oh, we want, yeah, the human rights perspective. I'm like, I can give you a perspective. I can't give you the perspective, because like I'll listen to like my peers and stuff like that. And if anyone will listen to them, like they'll probably agree. It's like, I have no idea what I'm talking about when it comes. Like, I have a decent idea. I have my views of this subject.
Right.
But there are so much out there. And like, there's certain views on human rights that like I don't agree with. I yeah. still think you need to know them, because like, just because I'm like, oh, I have a master's in it, so therefore I'm smart, so ignore so-and-so who wrote what, so what. And it's like, no, like, but that's just like my opinion. Like, you might have a better understanding of certain subjects. Go pay attention to that.
Right. But
going back to the book burning thing, which kind of makes me really nervous about modern day, is trying to explain. So I came into like, I was young enough to grow up with the internet, but I still remember the pre-internet age. I still remember going to the library to rent a VHS tape. like the internet being this thing that was, no one really understood what it was. Like, it was this tool, and like, that's like, I remember that page. So I remember your history was in books. Your history was the library. So the burning of histories, the burning of the Library of Alexandria, like that sense still makes sense to me. But now trying to imagine, like, explaining to a kid that just graduated high school, it's like the image of burning the books at the time, because they'll be like, well, it doesn't matter if they burn the books, it's on the internet.
Right. Just like,
well,
you know, that's so true. I haven't thought that part through it, but yeah.
But the scary thing is that, like, I was listening to another content creator from InRange, and he was like talking about like how Facebook and YouTube and a lot of other, like Twitter, were doing these purges of content.
Yeah.
Like just discriminately, just destroying content. And the whole thing is just like, okay, that's great that the books are on the internet, but these views and like, think about if your podcast was 100% on there and YouTube's like, we don't really want this, and deleted it, and you didn't have like a save file or backup, which I back up all my stuff.
Yeah.
But it's really crazy because we haven't learned from this whole entire idea of just wiping, because everyone's like, oh, once it's on the internet, it never goes away. It's like, it never goes away until the person holding onto your content decides they no longer want it there. And you saw that with Parler. I don't agree with what they say, but at the same point, it's just like, I can't use the words of the people from Parler as an example of what is hate speech if you erase the hate speech.
The hate speech.
It's very interesting that you talk about that. But I did also want to get into about your episode of the podcast, because you're doing all these perspectives of systemic racism in financial institutions. Could you give us like a broad summary or example of what this actually is?
Yeah, so the broad summary, the example is, when we look at financial services, we're looking at tools or programs associated with finances. So we're trying to look down through the system of finances in America primarily, and we're trying to see how racism might have been used to build some of those structures. So I referenced the Freedom Farm Act, which was like early, I'm not even going to give a date because I can't think of it right now. I want to say early 1900s. But the idea was that farmland that there was in the South, that a program was set up to help people recover from lost money and reconstruction and farmland and things like that. But one of the groups excluded were specifically Black farmers and Black home workers, as it was written in the law. So then what that did was that provided an opportunity for white Americans in the South and white Americans across the country to be able to acquire farmland for the sake of not only growing and earning for themselves, but then you get the opportunity to pass along inheritances to several generations following. You have examples of post-Civil War where the commonly known American phrase is 40 acres and a mule. And the idea was that General Sherman in Georgia, where I actually am now, in Georgia, spoke to some slaves that were being freed and said, what do you need? And they basically said, all we want is an opportunity to grow, build our own land, and to be able to fend for ourselves. And so as the Civil War was wrapped up, the Freedmen's Bureau Act pulled together confiscated land from Confederate members and was distributing it to freed slaves. And then as President Lincoln died, and Andrew Jackson stepped into place, they basically rescinded the lands and gave it back to the Confederate owners, thus kind of making Black Americans in that time, despite being freed slaves, turned them pretty much right back into a slave system, which they called apprenticeship in the moment. And then that was followed by sharecropping and other things. So then you have, once again, land, which is a primary use of wealth in America during that time frame. You had land that was unavailable to Black families and unavailable to Blacks. You have the inability to have businesses where if, for example, there were laws that were, if you were a Black business owner, you could not sue a white person in that time frame. So you have these injustices in these systems set up where you don't have the opportunity to actually create wealth so that you can pass along wealth. And so if you fast forward years over years over years, you have the inability to be able to get into home ownership systems. You have the lack of job opportunities that allow you to earn more money. So if you can only be a caretaker, or you can only take care of a home, or you can only be a butler or a person who's providing a service, that is maxed out at a certain income level, and then you go back to an area that you're only allowed to live in because of redlining or just because of even social racism, you go back to an area you're only allowed to live in, and then you, everything you pay for there is more expensive, or when you buy something on credit, it's a higher cost of credit than it is in your white areas, then you have this progression of a system that kind of locks you in and isolates you from that idea of a free market. So, you know, you don't have that chance to just go left or to go right or to go do what you want to do to earn money because you've been locked in to this closed system that already doesn't have a lot of income. And then the income that is in that area can easily leave that area through the banking systems and through the federal systems. And so we get into that a little bit. And we do talk a lot about it from a Black-white perspective, just because that's very prevalent in America. But we also try to speak a little bit more to minorities, because as you go through the years and as the years evolve, that started encompassing a lot more of Latino culture, a lot more of Asian culture in some aspects there.
No, and it's important you go. I just want to correct you on one thing when you said something, and I'm not going to try and be that thing. You said when Lincoln got assassinated that it was Andrew Jackson. It was Andrew Johnson. I just don't want people to get confused.
I appreciate it. I said Andrew Jackson yesterday, too. So thank you, Andrew Johnson.
Because no, the worst part about that is, like, right when you said that, I'm like, I'm pretty sure it was Johnson, but it wasn't LB Johnson. It was, like, I had to, like, that's where I looked at my phone. And, like, that's what you're saying. Like, I'm not being like, oh, he slandered Andrew Jackson's name. Like, he was a war profiteer and a racist from 60 years prior.
I'm running them together. But that goes back into what I'm saying. Like, no matter how much you try to be right, there are times things you throw out there incorrectly. And so that's the wonderful joy of, like, this is like, okay, wait a minute, it's Andrew Johnson. Thank you for correcting me.
No, it's also important too, we've both done it where, like, I was talking about the firearm company that was being racist. I didn't want to throw out a wrong name because, like, I don't want to throw shade on someone.
Right.
But the truth is, like, in the same thing when you were trying to figure out the date exactly for something, I think it's good to normalize admitting that we don't have all the facts right on hand instead of throwing out an arbitrary number, because someone's going to hear that arbitrary number like, oh, they're so smart, now I just pick someone up, like, no, please don't cite me, like, that's
once again, read the book your own.
I think it's an important thing where it's just like, you have to have respect for people that are like, I remember something, or let's say, like, don't quote me on this, I could be wrong,
there's,
and I think it's always important. It's like, I've seen this on other podcasts and on my own podcast. I will always respect someone that will start a sentence, I could be wrong or I'm missing something, but this is what I see, instead of saying statements like, I'm not racist, but like, if you have the same second sentence, you switch the two first sentences, like, once you say, I'm not racist, but I'm not listening to what the next part of your statement is. It's like, you're trying to say this as fact, but you're like, I might be missing something, but this is what I'm seeing. Are two total different. I think it's normalizing to, like, admit that we don't have all the figures, or we're not machines. We can't.
Yep.
And I know people can remember every single date of every single time. But also going back to what you're talking about from after the Civil War, I think it's a huge part thing that, which was weird, I didn't make this connection till while you were talking about it, sharecropping.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because people forget what, they don't know what sharecropping was. They're like, oh, well, we did give them their land, because, like, people would get the land and the way people, like, you can work this and then you sell us, you make the crop, then you give it to us, and then you can buy the stuff. And it's like, yeah, but they would loan you the tools that you have to pay for, which comes out of the salary of your product.
Yep.
And then when it goes out there, when you need to buy new things, you can then use the money that you're going for. It's like, oh, you need a new hoe, or you need a new rake, or you need something new. Oh, we'll just take it out of the sales of your harvest.
Yep.
And but the thing is like, doesn't this sound like something like auto loans?
Right.
Mortgages. Like,
sounds like predatory lending. It sounds like your auto title loans. that's more kind of what it compared to, because it was like the interest rate on loaning you equipment was so high that people who were doing that, freed Blacks, quote unquote, that had to go through the sharecropping process, were loaning equipment at such a high rate, you could never harvest enough money to get it back. And don't let you have a medical illness, because all that stuff was funneled through the house and you had to borrow to pay for your medical bill, which once again was so high that it was highly unlikely that you'd ever harvest enough to get out of that system.
And it's amazing that we didn't really teach this for a lot of schools, like, early on, or the fact that it's very selective with areas they'll teach it, because if you didn't know about sharecropping, Because it sounds like probably a great idea when you're walking into it. Like, how could this go wrong? Like, oh, like, they're, my boss is so nice. Like, he's going to let me go on this and pay it back later. And then you have minor towns in Kentucky, in West Virginia, which is literally using the same exact model on white people for the most part. But the thing is, if you don't teach them the history of, like, they learned they could manipulate this group this way, well, I can manipulate more. Okay, like, we're only going to use town money or company money.
Because one of those things, like when you talk about the miners in West Virginia or Kentucky, and it's often forgotten that when you first look back at American history, even when you look at it at racial history, there was a long period there where it was a lot more, well, at least let's say classism was almost equal to racism. Mm-hmm. And so poor white indentured servants could be treated the same, were treated almost the same as poor blacks. And at that point, they were both indentured servants. So you had black indentured servants. You kind of had your white indentured servants. And there was, theoretically, you had an opportunity to get yourself the freedom. And so there was an uprising where that balance was put into perspective, like, oh, wait a minute. If we can create this racism issue larger than that classism issue, then you have an opportunity to actually not have to worry anymore about the poor black and poor white indentured servant who's kind of getting the same anger and filled with the same outrage as that black individual. And so you had head right laws is what they're called. Go look it up. It's an interesting thing just to look up. But the reason I bring that up is pretty much to say, like, yeah, there are people who took those rules and those policies and used them right back on poor white Americans in the same exact way.
And before we go on this, when I'm talking about educational levels, it's like, I'm not trying to say, don't take that. I'm trying to say West Virginia or Kentucky didn't learn. Because if you're from that area and you're like, I learned that, it's like, yeah, but you most likely didn't grow up in the 1930s in a minor town where the second you're 10 years old, you know how to read your name and tell the time. You're working in the mines because you need to help pay off the debt that your parents got into because of the mine company.
Yeah.
Like, and the truth is the kids that could afford to stay in and learn about this stuff were probably the company children or the management children where they're learning about, oh, sharecropping. I can use that to exploit my neighbor. Like, they're not seeing it as something that they're being exploited by. They want to be the exploiters. And that's the reason I find it very fascinating, too, that, like, people are like, oh, unions became, like, a big thing. And, like, there's this modernization. Union's not a new term. Like, unions come around from, like, the 1300s with the guilds. It's just
not new at all.
Like, they're the artisans and the skilled workers and stuff like that. And, like, in truth is, like, if you really think about it, bar exams are one of a regulation to make sure your lawyer is qualified, but it's two to, it's your payment to the guild. It's payment to the union to operate.
That's your entry fee.
Yeah, it's your entry fee to get into it. So, but the thing is like the high skilled workers, like unions were working great for them. But the reason it's working great for them and they can charge all this money is because people aren't paying for the low skilled workers as much. These are conversations in, like, when you're talking about financial institutions about how they go, it's like, oh, this is supposed to be a podcast about financial institutions. And now you guys are talking about mining towns. Well, when the mining town is printing their own money, they're a financial institution.
Right, though. Associated with money. And then the thing is, you don't want, and I like that you bring in West Virginia, Kentucky. You can keep on going further north into Chicago and New York. Like, we're talking about sharecropping and we're talking about mining and things of that nature, but don't believe for a second that these common approaches didn't happen in, say, an inner city in New York or Chicago. So, like, when I'm referencing that concept of only having certain job positions that you can hold and then being only able to rent at a high rate and then being only able to furnish your house at a high rate and being able to only buy food at this terrible markup that is ridiculous so that it eats up all the money you're actually earning. Yeah, that was happening in New York. Yeah, that was happening in Chicago. So it's not like we look at these racial issues or these bias issues and they only happen in the South or they only happen in industrial areas or out areas like West Virginia, Kentucky. They were used by people in power wherever they were in power.
Which I always find funny about Andrew Carnegie, because Andrew Carnegie was the pinnable point of person against unions, but he is one of the prime reason there are unions because he is applied more to an educated person to create. He's like, go out and learn a library and learn education and like self-educate and learn yourself. And then people go to the libraries and learn about guilds and unions and ideas like, we should unionize. I can now understand what my rights are. I understand what this is. But then he's like, no, but I didn't want you to learn that. I wanted you to learn to be. So it's an interesting thing about Andrew Carnegie, how he kind of shot himself in the foot. Like in a lot of ways, I think he is a very important figure in American politics and a lot of stuff because he helped turn the tides into like workers' rights. But he didn't want to be that person.
By mistake. Totally by mistake.
But it's just one of those things where it's just like, I think that's also a good point too. When you look at history, like one thing I get very frustrated though too, is you'll have like people talk about Martin Luther King and like he did a lot of great things. And like they find out he wasn't a perfect man in some ways.
Yeah.
And people go, they find that one sin in the man and they try and use that to take everything down. And there are also other people, like, let's be honest, like Churchill. People like him, like Americans love Churchill. He did not do any favors to Greece. He did not do a lot of favors to a lot of like the Indians and like a lot of stuff. I'm like, but it depends on your perspective of it. But I think we have to keep that weighted response to a lot of these characters. Cause like Abraham Lincoln wasn't this perfect And Andrew Johnson did some bad things, but he was also put in a really weird spot where like he's like, and I feel bad because like Andrew Johnson looked into him. Like, I'm not saying he's perfect, but I feel like Joe Biden's going to be dealing with a similar situation where you're dealing with a war-torn nation. It's like, he's going to make some very bad, he's going to make mistakes. There are going to be mistakes made.
There's going to be some responsive mistakes, you know, reactionary mistakes. If anybody's from a Christian perspective or a religious perspective, I like to say, you know, there's one 100. You know, there's only one 100. Now, the other way to say that is growing up in the streets of Baltimore, I commonly heard from dudes on the street, especially those who are having gang issues, that you're like, you know, that dude, he ain't nothing but a human. He bleeds red just like me, you know, and I think that even applies to this situation. There is nobody, and I mean absolutely nobody, who is a 100% perfect or who has 100% of the right ideas or is doing something 100% correctly. Like, I don't care how good or how much you think or want to honor them. They've done something wrong. They've made bad errors. They've made mistakes. They're human. That's why they're human. That's why they live and they're going to die just like every other human. So you have to go into that knowing that there is no human being that is so great that they should be an idol for you, that they can't do anything wrong. Everybody does something wrong.
And the other thing I have to add to that is like, you might have people that like, you see certain politicians that like on paper, they've never done anything wrong, or maybe they have never done anything wrong, but have they ever, like, you have to learn by making mistakes. So has that person ever made a choice in their life?
Right.
You see some politicians that are like, he's never made a mistake, so he'll make like be a perfect politician. I'm like, has he never made a mistake or has he never made a choice? Like, that's what I want to know.
And that's a good one. My other one is, has he made a mistake and has been covered up? Like, there's so many different ways to go with that, you know? That gets us back into about a week out to what happened on Capitol Hill. It gets us back into that whole issues of not assessing mistakes, not assessing people as human beings, and where that can lead when you don't do that.
Which is such a... No, because it's too, when you're talking about like financial institutions, like a lot of times you have to talk about, you have to think about gambles.
Yeah.
And one thing I was thinking about this, and I was talking to a few friends, when you're talking about financial institutions, if you talk about Capitol Hill, like people are like asking, well, why were there so few law enforcement at Capitol Hill when they knew the Trump rally was? And it's like a few friends that are law enforcement made a very... I hate to agree, and I begrudgingly agree with them, but it is true, is that this is the first time that the hostility of a Trump rally exploded outside of the rally.
Hmm.
And it was like a weird thing to say. It's like, the Trump rally, like stuff happens, but the Trump rally was over a mile away. If anything happens, it always happens inside the rally. There's going to be violence, but it's going to be trained over there. They're going to come over here and they're just going to wave hands and protest because that's what it is. Like, no one's crazy enough to charge up. Like, how many times have people said they're going to charge the Capitol and like it never happens?
Never do anything.
And like, I think that's where they were going for it. But you do have that whole entire comparison, though, to the Black Lives Matter thing.
Right.
But they're going off the whole entire fact that, like, whenever... But then when you look at it and you think about it, it's like, well, whatever a bunch of group of black, and like they'll use like thing, like we really think about it. So when you get like a bunch of people that are upset from the African community or a minority community, does it usually turn into a riot? Yes. Is it usually their fault? No. But does it turn into, and it's like that gamble thing. And it's just, it's very.
And see, that's where I also admittedly have a problem like, I haven't thought about that perspective, and so I would need time to digest that. But I also think you can't put the two on comparison levels. So, for example, we're talking about systemic racism in financial services, which the first two words are systemic racism, which means there was a system that was created, and then there was a racism before we ever even got to the financial services part, right? Yeah. And so you're looking at that, and you're comparing it to BLM and Black Lives Matters and riots and issues there, but you're also comparing it to an issue that has been in this country for hundreds of years.
Yeah.
So you're saying, like, one of the things I almost wanted to post on immediately was people who supported the race, the insurrection to the Capitol, were mad, pissed off, angry, upset because of how they felt the election went. An election that was held in November. So we're talking about January, November, December, January. 3 months.
Yeah, they should have simmered down, yeah.
So you're violent over something that happens 3 months ago, and you expect Black people or minorities who have been suppressed for 300 plus years to be nonviolent. So when you put the, you can't balance them on the same level. And don't get me wrong, I'm not saying that riots should ever break out. I'm not a proponent of it. But when you're trying to compare 3 months to 300 years, and you're telling me anytime like LeBron James wears a t-shirt, it's not the right way to protest, or Colin Kaepernick gets on his knees, it's not a right way to protest. And he's protesting something that's hundreds of years old, but the right way to protest for something that's 3 months old is to storm the Capitol. I have a hard time balancing those two.
No, like, that's the whole other thing is what I was trying to talk about when you're talking about systemic racism and like balancing and like how governments, because most federal, like most institutions and like the government looks at things through like data analyst, which you can't look at everything through quantitative. You have to look at it through qualitative means. And no, I completely agree too. Like, I'm taking what the other side's saying and their perspective. I'm like, I'm not saying they're 100% right, but there are points there that I'm reluctantly like, you might have something there. Like,
Once again, I'm like, I got to think about that because I hadn't thought about it. So yeah, I hadn't heard that perspective. So,
and I think that's going to be a very interesting thing too, because I did want to bring up before we get into like media recommendations.
Yeah.
You have mentioned when I was on that you've talked to people in financial institutions that are like, oh, there is no systemic or systematic racism.
Yeah.
And I was just curious, like, what were the points that they were given? Or like, do you think it's just they're too far deep into the numbers that they're not paying attention to like how it affects the outside, or are we missing something?
I think part of what I've understood from those conversations is let's go back to history, for example, and you're talking about either Black History Month or even the concept of West Virginia and Kentucky history, and that you don't know it because you haven't been taught it and you haven't read it, right?
Yeah.
So if you have, and I'm thinking about a conversation specifically, so I'm thinking about this white guy I'm speaking to, a friend of mine, and I'm speaking to him, and he has never taking a look at the concept of white privilege. So he's 40, he's never looked at white privilege, not saying that he thinks it's a thing or not a thing. He's never even thought about it. It's not even on his radar. As someone in the financial industry, it not being on his radar means that he has never even looked at his financial structure as anything other than a system of numbers and breakdowns. So as I talk to him about, here are laws. Oh, yeah, that's the law. Yeah, we use that all the time. Did you ever look at how this law was applied in 1930 or 1960 or 1800? Oh, no, I've never looked at that. I never thought to look at it. I never knew to even study the history to look at it. So you have a level of ignorance there. Once again, I don't use ignorance in a pejorative manner. Ignorance just means you don't know. And so you have a level of ignorance there where you have people who haven't even thought to look at it because in their myopic perspective, it's not something on their radar. Secondly, you have people who, because you don't look through history, you don't understand how things are codified now. So when you talk about laws in the 1800s or 1900s, words like Negro appears in laws, you know, race identifiers appear in the laws. It's no issue back then. It's a sign of the times. But as times move forward, you can no longer use the word like Negro or Black in the law. So you start classifying people by job classes, or you start classifying them by zip codes. And you know that if all Black people primarily live in this zip code, yeah, you might have one or two that kind of quote unquote slip through, but you know you've gotten the majority taken care of. So we'll release this policy that works except for zip codes 1, 2, 3, and 4. And so unless you're willing to understand that some of this racism, as it is applied today, is just codified in order for you not necessarily to be able to see it, you won't necessarily recognize it unless you're really paying attention to recognize it. So when you have something that's specifically for not for urban communities, or this program is specifically for enterprise zones, but not this one, you know, you're using codified language to kind of nail in on one demographic or one group of people through this language that pretty much is identifying racially or based on class systems as well, where people are located. And unless you know to look for it, then you don't see it. And then on top of that, once you do know to look for it, you have to make your decision whether or not you care enough to do it. Because when I say I don't have a problem with ignorance, I do have a problem when you allow yourself to stay ignorant.
You know, it's interesting too, when you're talking about that, like two major things popped in my mind. And one is like the confusion of tax code, where it's like, if you're someone such as myself, it's just like, I just don't, tax code is so confusing. It's such a language that I don't even want to bother. And like, yeah, I go to H&R Block to get my taxes done, but I don't even want to sit down and talk to them and itemize all my stuff. It's like, here it is, just do the basic thing. Like, but I don't know how much money I'm losing out of that deal.
Right.
Even though like we're the majority pay, but the rich people that are our friends that are probably setting these policies, they can throw a couple thousand dollars to an accountant to handle it all. So them is nothing. And they're probably saving 10 times on that because of that investment, where you and I, it's just like, if we sat down and itemized it, could we save a couple thousand?
Yeah.
Yeah. But it's not worth my time and energy, when half that money I save will go right back to the accountant that I hired to go figure this out anyways, because that's the value of their work. And you have, so you have that on top of it. The other thing I was thinking about was, we were talking about like how government agencies, they do a lot of mathematic analysts. The thing I found very interesting is, I'm very fortunate with all my loans. I only have one loan, and all my loans is federal. But the reason all my loans is federal is my undergraduate was paid by the VA.
Yeah.
And then when I took out loans, it was for a postgraduate degree. And the difference is like, anyone that's listening that's used the federal loan system, directly from the federal government, every undergraduate's allowed up to $20,000 a year for education. Yeah. If you're a postgraduate, such as myself, such as master's or PhD, they'll cover 100% of whatever it is. Because once you're at the level of postgraduate, it means you already have a college degree. So you're more than likely to
complete it.
Not even just complete. Even if you fell out, you already have an undergrad.
Gotcha.
Like you're basically what you'd call like a low risk investment.
Gotcha.
Where they look at undergraduates as a high risk investment. And I'm like, well, why are we looking at why that high risk investment is? And then you think about it, like, well, who's the ones people taking out these loans? Like, yeah, everyone takes out the federal loans, but the people that are less likely to get all these scholarships, because I hate when people go like, oh, there's all these scholarships out there that are for people of this discrimination and that discrimination and that discrimination, but they still make up a minor portion. Like me being a white male, I am still 70 times more likely to get like a certain grants and scholarships than non-white males. There's a reason why those are there, like that they're for very, they're, because if they're not, then I'm going to get those too. Like, I don't understand why there is a really good propaganda on that. You have to get down and understand the math and actually understand what you're reading, which means learning research, which we're really bad as Americans.
Yep.
But that goes back to the question, though, is I wonder how that affects into race. Because if you're coming from a low, poor community that's affected by redlining and a lot of racial issues back in the day, your schools probably aren't the best. So the chances of you even getting into a college, or you do get into a college because you'll have places, certain charter schools. Yeah, 90% of our students get into college. Do you ever see the graduation date of one, like, well, that's great, 90% of it. But if you look at it, some of them have like a 15% graduation of those colleges.
Yeah.
So those 90% of those students definitely took out student loans. The chances of them paying them back is even less than that 15% that graduated.
Yeah.
And so you're good dealing with a situation where it's like, yeah, you have a policy, but like, I don't blame the government for being like, oh, you're taking out college loans for undergrad. Like, you're a high risk investment for undergrad. But we're not paying attention to why are they a high-risk investment. How did college become a high-risk investment?
Right. One of the things you alluded to is when you're talking about how, it's because you're not looking at this picture where it's one thing. It's a compounding of several different things. Even when you're looking at, so let's take systemic racism and financial services. You have compounding things there alone. And then let's take systemic racism. You have compounding things there alone. And then beyond that concept, you have several compounding things. If you ask why the podcast is called Open Windows Culture and not, for example, Open Windows Racism, it's Open Windows Culture because I think culture is truly where we need to get to be able to understand the variations, the differences, and the motivations of multiple people. We have to be able to see that there are many lines of intersection. And when we look at the surface, we forget to dig deep enough to find out where those ultimately where those other lines of intersection are. And so while this first series is about racism, the second series is going to end up being about something completely different. And the third series might be about something completely different because we're focusing on the concept of culture. And the idea being that if we can learn how to understand other cultures, then we can learn how to apply that across the board to multiple places.
No, that's great. Sorry, we got a question in, and I was just, while you're talking about that, it really threw me off, the questions that were asked. So I'm going to open it up right now, though, to four questions.
Gotcha.
I don't want to cut you off on what you're saying because it actually was really important and I was listening. But I was also wanting to give you a moment to talk about any media you recommend for people to learn about this, or if you want to talk about your podcast for a moment, and I'll let anyone that's listening live to ask questions so we can get back to those.
Okay. On my end, it's the Open Windows Culture podcast, and you'll be able to find that on Spotify, Apple, Google, all the good places, as well as I do have a book, Open Windows Culture, The Christian's Guide. And what I did in there was I actually took the concept of talking about culture and how do you apply it spiritually. It's a lot less probably here's everything from the Bible you need to know and a lot more. Here's how you take soft skills training that I would do for a corporate organization and combine it with some biblical principles and how do you put it in real use so that you can sit down with somebody from different communities and actually learn how to involve the strengths from that community into who you are as a human being, and then take it to systems as well. One of my favorite books, I love this book, I think it speaks greatly to the Black male coming of age story. It's called White Boy Shuffle by Paul Beatty. I believe it's a beautiful book. He speaks in certain levels of absurdness into how he's written a novel, but it is also speaks to just American culture as a whole, which I love. Development as Freedom by Amartya Sen, A-M-A-R-T-Y-A. I believe is correct spelling for that. He speaks about economic freedom and development of cultures of nations. It's an international, written about an international economics perspective. And he breaks down like economies into five areas where he talks about stuff like public health and how that affects economic growth and development of freedom, as well as finances and everything. And if something I'm just a fan of, I believe it is, and we talked about this before, George, I believe it is just a representation of where storytelling and movie making and stuff can really go when given an opportunity and chance and finances and somebody believes in it. I love Lovecraft Country and I love Lovecraft Radio, a podcast that's associated with that. I just think those two are great to check out. And The Path by Lori Beth Jones. That's a book I live by. It's about creating your own life mission and how to develop that and where to go once you've developed that.
Oh, thank you. And I will definitely add all that to my guests and appearances page and my book recommendations with a summary All right. And where to find this. The two recommendations I'm going to have are two different podcasts, one being Here Now the News with Jerry Barmish, who was my last guest from an episode that's about to be aired. He does a news podcast, which he's a veteran New York City journalist and news anchor. And he talks about the things that are happening right now. And he sits down with former governors and stuff like that. So that's a very interesting podcast to go. Another one, which is one that I've been kind of one of my, I guess, my guilty pleasures. I find firearms fascinating, but like not just in the point of pew pew, but like I find the history of them fascinating. There's one called History Unloaded. It's done by two curators, like museum curators. One formerly worked at the Smithsonian in DC, and they've done a three-part on the history of firearm laws, which surprisingly, when you look at firearm laws, a lot of it, and they go heavily into detail, it's a lot of it's very much race driven, like such as like when licensing and registration happened. Like I never knew how much the few photos of the Black Panthers holding firearms affects modern day firearm history. And it's just like, yes, I agree that licensing and registration should be a thing, but it scares me how it became a thing.
Yeah.
And like, that's one of those things. It's not as like, some things it's important. Like, oh, I might agree with that policy now, but where did that policy come from? So I highly suggest if you're like firearms or like, even if you're someone that's against firearms, I feel like this is a very neutral place to learn a lot about the history. And if like, I'm not advocating if someone wants to become an anti-gun advocate, but like learn the history of it so you can help judge the conversation better. I think that's a very safe place to go if you want to learn. I'm not sure if that's a good way to go with it. So I did get two questions from the same person, and I'm gonna mix up the name. It's like Jananian or GGN. Oh, I'm just messing it up. And the first question is, well, it's not really a question, it's more a statement. It's like, I'm a minority. My two cents in that we should be pushing human race instead of race. And I get this a lot. Like, it's just like, why are we like, I'm a human first. And I'm like, that's really great. But the problem isn't like, this is my intake on it. Like, I'll let you go on it. Just when I see this human talking about race before race. So the human race is like a species over that. Like, that's a great sentiment. The problem is that we're a rights-based law and we're a case law-based society. So the policies that we're talking about, it's like, yes, we wish that would be the way, but you have to cut back so much red tape and examine these things to make sure. Cause when you're like, yeah, we should focus on human race. But the problem is like, we're all part of this race. So we're focused on the human race by making sure certain portions and groups in the communities within that human race aren't being negatively affected by the policy. So I get the segment, but it's just like the best way to help the human race is to make sure that everyone is given an equal opportunity with equal standing, but we have to go back and make sure and see why we're not there right now.
And I'll admit that race is a hard issue for me. Even when I do this during the day, once again, going back to why I call it open windows culture has to do partly with race. Because if you go back in time, culture is what was discussed before race. Race was an idea created, and I believe it was like 1453, and you needed a justification when, I think it was Gomez de Sarava needed a justification for why they bypassed North African slave traders to just go into Africa and grab their own group of slaves. And they just batched all these African slaves together, and they were like, oh, we need something to call them. They're black. And so you created this concept of race at that time. Up until that point, people were delineated and defined by cultures. It was the culture. These group of people were culture. They were darker skinned, but they were this culture. And that group over there to the west, they were that culture. And so one of the reasons I'm so big actually on talking about culture is because if we can learn how to focus on somebody's culture and focus on the inside of somebody, then we can get past race. Race is a skin shallow concept. The problem with discussing race is oftentimes when you get to talking about race, you forget that there's somebody deeper beyond that skin that people are seeing. And so I want to talk about culture much more than I ever want to talk about race. But I also have to try and figure out that balance because I sometimes can't get people to the conversation of culture without going through race, unfortunately. Race doesn't always apply the same way, you know? So if somebody's looking at me as a black guy, looking at somebody else they know, or African-American, usually the term, but they're assuming he's a black African-American, but he's Jamaican. He sees himself as Jamaican. My ex-father-in-law saw himself as Trinidadian, you know? So we get stuck up on this surface issue without understanding the deep down cultural issue. And I honestly believe if race was created, then race can be eliminated and we can get back to the concept of culture and inside and understanding people's actions and motivations of their actions culturally versus racially.
And I think that goes really well into the way that I kind of want to answer this next question, because it's not a bad question. It's a question that needs to be answered. It's just when I say this, you're going to realize why I'm like, I'm hesitant to address it. It's not that I don't think it should be addressed. It's a dangerous question, but dangerous in the fact that like, it's important to be answered, but answered correctly. That's where I'm going with this. And it's that I have a question. If Black Lives Matters are about valuing Black lives, why are they not going after the people that take the most Black life? And the reason why, like, I understand where this question is going, but the way that it's answered thing, it's basically going against the whole 100% that, like, most Black people kill Black people, or Black people are most likely killed by Black people. And it's like, that's not what Black Lives Matter, and when we're talking about these financial institutions and culture, is talking about. Because if you're looking at just the numbers without understanding the full context, yes, you're right. But going after the people, it's, but why are they killing? Because if you want to go over violence, we're talking about culture. One thing like I've always found fascinating is like, I go back into my guilty pleasure of firearms, but the two states that have the least firearm violence and less homicide is Vermont, that has no gun laws. My home state of Massachusetts has the most gun laws. And people, so both sides are like, look, the state with the least don't have problems, or the state with the most don't have problems. They just kind of both being held by pedestals of two different groups. But no one's paying attention to the fact that Massachusetts has the most college graduates per capita, second most high school graduates per capita. Vermont has the most high school graduates per capita, second most college graduates per capita.
Yeah.
So they have opportunities to get a job, which means they're not being forced to get into high risk, high reward scenarios to get money, such as the drug trade, or such as I have to protect myself because I can't afford a security system. So therefore someone might come and like, then you have to buy a gun illegally because there's some weird racist law on firearms and stuff like that. And the situations in this areas that have the worst violence tend to be, interestingly enough, the states that Trump tried to sue, but at high areas of African-American culture. But like that goes back to a lot of this other things where they weren't given the 40 acres and a mule and the actual right. proper. And so this is a, you can talk like, I'm just trying to say like, ooh, it's an important question, but you have to be delicate with this.
So I hope the person who asked this question will hear me and listen to understand me from the way I say this. I often worry about two different ways that we tend to look at problems in this world. One, we look at it from a dichotomous perspective. It's good or bad. It's one or the other. It's up or down. It's left or right. As if there are no other components involved in these things. And we also look at them from this linear perspective. One thing begets the next thing, begets the next thing, begets the next, and that's it. And we forget to think about the multiple layers and effects of things going on. Now, you want to talk about blacks killing blacks. Do I have an issue with that? Yeah. I even have an issue with the N-word. Shoot, I don't even cuss if you want to be honest. I have an issue with a lot of stuff. But if you talk about blacks killing blacks, there's a couple of different ways we can take this, for example. Number one, the highest rate of murder of any race or culture is generally the person in that race or culture. So the highest murder of a white person being killed is generally whites killing whites. So you have that you need to apply there. But let's not stop there, because that's just throwing out one thing to recognize. Secondly, you have to ask, what is one reason that could be the case? I grew up in the city of Baltimore, which is definitely not considered would be considered upper classes of cities. You think about the shows that were made there, The Wire, Homicide. You're thinking about shows about drug dealing and killing and things of that nature. Now, if you take a group of people and you lock a group of people into an area, essentially with redlining and other systemic things and financial components, and you're having a hard time getting out that area, you have $10 and everybody is struggling to get that $10, you're going to have conflicts that breaks out. Now, let me be clear. That would be the same no matter what race or culture you're talking about. If you take anybody and you put them in a closed area and say you have to fight to eat, guess what's going to happen? People are going to fight to eat. You use the example of gun laws in Vermont. You use the example of gun laws in Massachusetts, right? Now, let's even flip it to, if we go into the realm of politics, we'll talk about pro-life versus pro-choice. And if you look at the numbers, and feel free if you're listening to go research this. If you look at the numbers of pro-life versus pro-choice, or if you look at the abortion rates, that's what I'm really getting around to. You look at your abortion rates during the time frames where abortion was illegal versus the time frames where abortion was actually legal. You'll probably notice that there is actually a correspondence where abortions actually go down in the times where it's legal as opposed to illegal. So if you're asking why is that, it's largely one thing it could be tied to is the concept of hope. I have the hope of choices. I have the hope of opportunity. I have the hope of a chance. Now, if you take that back over to a point where you're talking about low income, you're talking about being suppressed or repressed by programs, you're talking about lack of inheritance or money to move and have an opportunity, you're talking about the fact that you were born into a zip code, and there's actually a phrase now where we talked about it on the show, zip code determines your destiny at this point. Like, so you're talking about this point where you're in a physical area where your hope is to get out. And what you do is you become hopeless because there are not many opportunities to get out. You start responding, acting, and treating like a hopeless person. So we look at, take a serial killer, take a murderer, remove it out of the black sphere, right? Let's move it to any sphere you can think of across the world. Take a murderer and tell me if that murderer expressed some level of hopelessness. Now, if you take that level of hopelessness and you put it all in this confined, closed area and say, hey, you know, what do you expect? I had a guy in high school, 14-year-old. Guy in 14-year-old in college. Father had died. Mother was sick with cancer. So she's getting in. Mother was employed by like a mom and pop grocery store or something of that nature. So not a big store. And in Baltimore, there aren't lots of chains or anything. A lot of large companies fled the area because they just didn't see profit in low income inner city Baltimore. And so you have a lot of independently owned shops. So you have a guy whose father is dead, a mother who's sick with cancer, can't work, a 14-year-old with three siblings, and they have to figure out how to pay their rent and pay their bills. Now, this 14-year-old can hop a taxi or a bus to go to a job, but that job is paying, at that time, $7 minimum wage. He can only work 20 hours a week because he's a child being employed. That's $140 before you take out $30 in taxes. Now, you tell me what rent, what food is that going to pay for? So when that 14-year-old goes out to sell drugs, because that's the only industry where he can make enough money to try and pay the bills and to keep his family in a house, is he a bad guy because he's trying to work in a scenario that he's got? And so when we look at these pictures and we're saying, oh yeah, police brutality, we shouldn't worry about that as much because blacks are killing blacks. You have to take it away from trying to be in these simple columns of, well, black kills black people more than cops kill black people. Well, what is the scenario wrapped around what is happening when black people kill black people? What is the scenario wrapped around when you have police brutality towards black people? And let me tell you, I can speak from both sides of that. All right. I've been held at gunpoint by a cop for doing nothing. I've been held at gunpoint by drug dealers and been caught in a couple of drive-thrus. So I've been on both sides of this plate. And I can tell you very much so that when you look at the Black Lives Matter movement and you think to yourself, blacks are killing blacks, why isn't that the issue? My question then comes for you. Why haven't you read more? Why haven't you researched more? Why haven't you determined for yourself why that is the issue? Why haven't you read about why blacks killing blacks is a big thing versus why protesting is a big thing? Like, we can't stop at asking the issue and expecting for, in my biggest, grandest hope here, I want the person who asked that question to actually put in the broad scale of things, what is everything else feeding into that that creates that scenario, so I can become better at understanding why I'm asking that question.
No, it's really important too, because like right when you were talking about that, you made a good point, because white people are more likely to attack white people. When you take out murder, you take out homicide, and you switch in sexual assault, sexual harassment, you're more likely to be sexually assaulted by someone that you know than someone in the ring. But does that change the fact that when we are raising our children to be like, oh, don't worry, Johnny or Jenny, you're not going to be attacked by a stranger because it's statistically less likely. No, you're still aware of that.
Right.
Like, you're still aware that you could be attacked by someone. Like, yes, right. The chances of
you can say black American. It's fine with me. You can even just say black.
With someone, when a black person goes out, yes, they're... You also have to like remember the numbers. Are they astronomically lower number chance of them getting killed by a cop than another person that's black? Yes. Yeah. But it's still also astronomically higher for them to get killed by a cop than someone that is white.
Right.
So by focusing on the wrong numbers, and I hope when I use my analogy and answer this question, I wonder if you have any criticisms the way that I was talking about, because I was just focusing on like opportunity. Why less than?
No, I actually don't. Like, I'm trying to remember exactly your analogy. I heard part of it, and then some of it I sucked at listening to understand on that one myself.
It was just basically the fact that, like, when people try and focus on numbers and, like, deaths and homicide and murder, it's like, fact is murder happens in places where you don't have many other opportunities. Like, no one really goes out to murder for murder. It usually is in a store robber go wrong, or someone feels like they feel unsafe or something like that. And I'm like, that normally doesn't happen in white suburbia.
Yeah.
Like, if it does, it's all over the news.
Yeah. Like, for example, I've been held point blank gun range about 3 times, right? One time I walked into a neighbor's house directly across the street. Drug dealer was stealing from the neighbor who's, I don't even know what he was into. I, he was the older brother of the dude I was there going to hang out with. And I walk in, I got a gun in my face, and I'm 12 at this point. So it's not an age where you want to be in that position. And so you have that time, but I also have two times I'm held at gunpoint by cops. Now, the two times I was held at gunpoint by cop, the cop followed me for 2 miles, waited for me to turn on my signal light, then pulled me over because he said, because I used my signal light, I might be drunk. So we're clearly making up a reason to pull me over. The second guy, the second cop who pulled out his gun on me was in a security booth asleep. When I threw a can into a trash can, it happened to bounce off the security booth, and he comes out of the security booth with his gun drawn, pointed at me. So you're trying to weigh what is the motivation at the time for this gun being drawn. You can't remove the position of power, the position of responsibility, the position of what you're supposed to do and where you are from the scenario of what is happening. One person is hopeless trying to make money, and I don't know if they're hopeless. I'm probably giving more credit than I need to because they're robbing somebody's house. You know what I mean? But the other person is in a position of responsibility where they're following me looking for a reason to pull me over.
And it's true. And I've had cops not point a gun at me, but pull their firearm at their work. But like, it's situations where like I was in a really nice rental car in a rundown part of Boston, and my friend that was driving our rental car went the wrong way on a road. Like, it just, we got pulled over for a legitimate reason, but being from a different area, started moving, me being a Bostonian, blue lights go on, hands go on the dash. Like, right. That doesn't, at 2 o'clock in the morning, hands go on the dash. But it also is interesting because it's a cultural thing. And like, because the cops like go, and it was interesting when I had a conversation with him afterwards, just because of the fact that the way that he's dealt with police, also being a white person from a more red state, and me being a white person from a blue state, being very aware of the surrounding of the time that I'm in, that it's night, it's 2 o'clock in the morning, two white kids in a nice car.
Yeah.
They're like, this creators aren't for joyride. They're marking us for something else. And it's, to me, like, I feel like I was properly profiled to a degree at that point. But it is interesting you're dealing with that. But like, also the fact is the gun wasn't pointed at me.
Yeah.
I was alert to know, like, oh, this guy has a gun on him. And like, there's that, the times I've had guns pointed at me were military, but that was, it's just like, when you think about
And to be clear, too, I don't think that all cops are bad. So I want to make sure I'm clear on that. And I don't even think that all times you pull somebody over, it's a racial thing. So it's, once again, you got to balance out a lot of information at the same time and not try to go on this linear thought of this one thing happened, therefore it's all this.
Well, it's also the same thing, too, is, like I said, I have a lot of friends. I was studying to be law enforcement. Traffic stops are the most nerve-wracking thing for a law enforcement officer. Because if they're going to be shot or ran over, it's during that time. Like, that's traffic, they're stops. On yeah traffic stops the yeah. worst for them, and they don't know anything about you, they don't know who you are. So the truth is don't make sudden movements. Like, I'm maybe that's just because I grew up in the city. Like, don't make sudden movements, be polite, because the thing is, like, most people don't realize when you're in this situation, much more different if you're not white, both you and that law enforcement officer in the situation, the second those blue lights hit and you guys stop at that traffic stop, all he wants to do is survive and go home to his family. All you want to do is survive and go home to your family.
Yep.
You guys have the same two missions, and it sounds strange about that. But once you realize, for the most part, hopefully you're on the same level, but you're scared, he's scared. Like, that's just...
And that's why I think it's so important to talk about culture, because if we talk about race, it's a black and white thing.
Yeah.
If we talk about culture, it's a you're scared, I'm scared. Okay, we're both scared. Why are we both scared? All right, how do we find a middle ground so we're neither of us are scared? You know what I mean? You get to remove that obstacle. You get to acknowledge it, but you get to remove that obstacle to come to, all right, fine. If you're scared approaching the car, this is a better way and a better technique to do it. If I'm scared with you coming towards my car, this is a better way, better technique for me to be able to see it.
Which is something that I was thinking about, and I wish we would do this, because I remember cops coming to the school for the DARE program when I was younger. Like, don't do alcohol, don't do drugs. with the tiger, and or was it a lion? I can't remember. It was a big cat.
I thought it was a tiger. Tony the Tiger knockoff.
Oh, it was like, yeah, I think it might have been a lion. But like, it's the whole entire... But the one thing I'm trying to realize is, like, they don't teach us in school, which I think they should. I learned this from friends and family that are law enforcement. We should probably teach our kids how to deal with law enforcement in a situation like that.
Yeah. Now, like, I guarantee you in a black family, that is something that happens.
But I'm wondering why we don't do it at the educational level. Like, we don't teach civics anymore, but like, you're gonna the chances of you dealing with law enforcement over dealing with a firefighter is 1,000 times more likely.
Yeah.
Like, why don't we teach them?
The firefighter gets a privilege because they have a truck. They got the truck for you to get on. But I, you know, it's funny because when you start going to education, you start leading me out into so many other areas, because I feel like education doesn't spend enough time talking about how you communicate better. Like, think about so many of the issues that we have fall under the line of not defining the same, fussing about the same word with different definitions. For example, respect. Anytime anybody in a session uses like the word respect around me, I'll stop.
I just want to start singing.
Define it. What the heck does respect mean? Like, your definition of respect is going to be different than my definition of respect from somebody. So you have a lot of conflict that just comes from not communicating clearly, or at least not communicating on equal levels. And then you have goals and just being able to understand how to do goal planning and set up some real goals. We've talked about research and understand. So there's so many different things that just come out, like the soft skills side of me that are like, that I think apply so much more to real life than some of the things that are in school. But
it's also the weird thing too, though, is like, where do you take this out? Like, they've already taken arts out of school, and like, but I want to put that back in. And they're like,
sadly,
then they're talking,
right.
And it's like, they took out civics, and I'm like, but what do we replace with that? And then people go, well, kids don't need to know this advanced mathematics. I'm like, sadly, they do, because if you ever want to give the chance for Sally or Joe or Krishan or whoever, I'm sorry, I'm using white names. I'm just trying to, like, those are the ones that pop out. But if you want to give them a chance to be in engineering, they need to know that basic math. They're not going to be like, they're not going to do, this is math 101. Like, no, you need to understand how to do trig if you want to get into engineering to begin with, because you have so much. So it's like, at the point, like, when it comes to history, I'm upset because there's so much history we don't teach. But I think a big point of that for the history is like, can we just teach our kids the proper history from day one, and not every single time when you go, forget when you get to like fourth grade, everything you learned from 1 and 3 was completely wrong. Now I'm going to teach you the proper. And then you get to sixth grade, everything you've learned before this is wrong. I'm like, why do we keep doing this? Can't we just teach it right from the beginning? Like, well, we don't want the blood and gore and about the Native Americans and all this other stuff. It's like, maybe we should just.
But maybe we should.
We should. Like,
maybe we should, because it's called real.
Yeah.
It's the same principle of why I don't let my kids use the word fair in the house. It's the same principle. Life is real. So just teach them. They'll be fine. Matter of fact, they'll be the more responsible adults if we can just be comprehensive from the jump.
But no, it's true. All this goes back to education, and it.
Yeah.
I don't know what the answer for education is, because just think about like everything that every person that you think you talk to, they took out something they find important, and there's something in there that they find useless. But it's like, well, I find that useless, but someone else might find that needle. Right. And you also have to understand, like, the point of public education is to try and get us on an equal ground. But you are learning a lot from your family. But like, I didn't need to learn a lot about how law enforcement works, because I have family that's law enforcement, or how the U.S. Constitution works. My dad's forced me to read the Constitution since I was 10 years old. I already had that aspect. So that lack in school didn't affect me. But not everyone had that, or their parents were teaching them how to rebuild an engine from nuts and bolts. But like, I didn't get that education. Yeah. And so like, that's where I think that it gets really confusing where to put into public school and what not to, where I'm going to be very fascinated going forward into this homeschool, hybrid online education. I'm going to be very curious how that goes forward.
Yeah. That removes the space of having uniformity in that education process.
You can slow down for the slow kids, which slow does not mean stupid. It just means it probably means that we just haven't learned the best way to educate you.
You could just be a person. We use slow in so many broad perspectives. It just could be a kid who processes differently. It's not that they're necessarily slow. The way they learn, like, you have three concepts of learning. You have that auditory, that kinesthetic, that visual learner, right? And that's before you get into the other realms of like Gardner, who has like eight more, or who has eight total or something like that, right? But when you're in elementary school, you primarily get a blend of all three. And then as you get older, it all becomes auditory by the time you get to college, right? Mm-hmm. So, but what about the kid who doesn't learn primarily in one of those three segmentations? We'll classify them as a slow processor, but they're not necessarily a slow processor. They just learn and process differently than the way you're teaching.
No, and that's like the whole other thing that gets a lot, because what we were talking about that too, it also reminds me of like processing. It's like, you can learn to read fast. Like, I remember so many times, like, oh, I'm a fast reader. I don't remember anything in the last 20 pages. Like, I knew what those words are, but I didn't combine them into like a plausible thought. And like, the thing is, like, that slow reader kid probably understands, like, he's going to go read that book once.
Right.
That's the only time he ever needs to probably read
but
that.
But he digested 95% of it.
Where it's just like, I remember the title and the last word of the book, but you read it. I read it. I don't retain it. Like, and it's amazing about how that's going to go. And I just don't. And I hope the person that asked the question, they answer. And it's not when I was like saying, like, I'm hesitant. And when I say like a question can be dangerous, it's not like, oh, we knew to ignore it. It's just means that we need to be very, make sure you understand what we're saying. Like, as you said, because if we're using a terminology that they don't understand, that's a problem. Right. It's also like, it seems like a simple question, but it really, really is not a simple question.
It's not a simple question at all. And then it's one of those things where you're trying to balance answering it emotionally with answering it logistically or analytically, because I'm a firm believer you don't want to have all of one and none of the other either. So you have to understand there's an emotional component and an analytical component, but I want to answer it in a way that makes sense and is, well, makes sense, understandable, you know?
Well, I think that's a huge thing too, when we're talking about on your podcast, because we're on a log far away from where we're talking about systemic racism and financial institutions. But it is kind of true though too, because the questions like this, it's like what we're even talking about, and I'm going to be fascinated when you go through it just from the short conversation that we had when I was on. It's these little policies and things that we're talking about, people are like, well, why are you talking about this when this is also an issue? It's like, yes, that's an issue, but if we fix this brick.
Yeah.
Like, the thing is, like, you first have to lay the foundation of the cathedral before you can put the gargoyle on top. So the fact that you haven't put the gargoyle, like, you need to lay the foundation. And if things start leaning, it's like, we're going to have to change this. And I think that's another part of the problem, is people just want a...
not a quick fix.
Yeah, it's not. And it's like, it always just reminds me of like the old cartoons where they start pushing something one way and then it starts leaning the other and they have to run around. But that's what politics is right now. And the fact that when people promise quick fixes, don't believe them. Like, I don't think there's... the only quick fix is just erase everything and try and start from new, but then you just have a whole new problem.
That's not a quick fix either. You know, because I like to think about it from, I can't think of anything, and I could be wrong, I can't think of anything that is good that takes less time than doing the bad version. You know what I mean? So for example, you want to gain weight and you want it to be fat. Oh, you can do that in a weekend. You can't gain muscle in a weekend, nor can you lose that weight you gained in a weekend. You want to spend $1,000? Oh, you can buy a bunch of stuff that's useless for $1,000. But you can't take that $1,000 and put it into something that's going to grow and make you money anywhere near as quickly as you can spend it and lose it in something that's pointless. So the bad, the negative side of anything generally takes, my math is, it's like a 3-to-1 ratio. It takes 3 times as long to do it the good, right way than it does to take it, do it the bad way.
Yeah, I think I said, I think when I was on yours, I said, when people look at like, oh, I feel like we're taking 1 step forward and 2 steps back. And well, if you take a step forward and you found out the foundation you're stepping off of is rotten, you have to go 2 steps back to fix it. Yep. And it's like, if every single time you take a step forward, you're taking 2 steps back, that's a bad thing.
Right.
Or like, it's a really rotten platform you're on. But just because you fall, and it's just like, when we go back to more talk about research, like my dissertation, I did a lot of research. I got to the conclusion, I'm like, I asked the wrong question. I did my research, didn't answer the question I was looking for. But people are like, oh, so you failed your research. I'm like, no, I passed it because I didn't find the answer I was looking for. I just found the wrong way to answer the question, which eliminates it for the next person behind me. And now I have new questions or things that I thought were important relevantly, like not really are this relevant. And I think that's what the problem is like people always like to know that like Edison invented the light bulb, or quote unquote invented the light bulb, but he tried 1,000 times and failed. And I don't consider those, it's just like he didn't fail, he just found 1,000 ways not to build a light bulb. And I think we have to remember that's how politics work.
Yep, and that connects to that. It connects to your politician who has no errors on their record. Like, it's not if you fail, it's when. Like, if you're doing anything substantial, if you're doing anything where you're actually pushing, building that foundation and pushing something major forward, it's a when you fail. Like, you're going to take a wrong step at some point. You're just going to. So understand that that is going to happen, and that wrong step is not a reason to stop. It's a reason to learn. Take what you learn and then move forward in the right direction. But understand, you're going to fail. You're going to make a wrong step. You're going to say the wrong thing somewhere.
And sometimes when it goes like a lot of things, like it's interesting you were talking about like white privilege and stuff. Sometimes when you realize that you make a mistake, it's not a bad thing to like take it and allow it to be for like when I really got into it, it was an emotional time for me. Like that was, it's like, because you realize like, oh, like I should have said something or I didn't say something or I wasn't in the power to say something when it comes to a lot of stuff. And it's not a bad thing to fail. And it's not a bad thing to examine it, allow your emotions to take control. But I always say, allow your emotions, sort your emotions, take action after.
Yeah.
Like, don't act while you're in that emotional state. Yeah. Like, because then you're going to make mistakes. But it's all right to be emotional, which I think is, like, that gets into toxic masculinity and, like, so many other issues. But it's all right to be emotional. It's all right to be angry. It's all right to be angry at yourself.
Yep.
Which is something we have to process.
Yep.
And the next thing, though, is, which I love about your podcast, you always want to end with an action.
Yeah.
And I was going to ask, what everything that we've talked about right now, like, what is an action that you, from everyone that you've interviewed for your process going through this? Yeah. And like, I'll reiterate for the listeners, we didn't get too much into it, but if you want to get into very much perspectives and very much into the details of financial institution systemic issues, listen to him on Open Windows Culture. But what is an action that you, from everything we've talked about today and all about that, like, what's an action you say that we can make right now?
So the rundown on the perspectives we talked about, I've talked about on that podcast, I had someone coming in talking about taxes, someone from the entrepreneurial venture capital side of the world, someone who had a $41 million a year company who had to shut down because he couldn't get financing because he was in the inner city. I had you on talking about GI Bill issues and associated with GI Bill issues, which is a good one. I had someone who is international. So they're American who now has worked through Peace Corps, who's worked through several nonprofits in public health and economics across the world. He lives in Switzerland now. So giving us that outside to the insider view.
Oh, so he's in my realm of the world.
Yeah, he's in your realm of the world. And then I had another one who's already working on trying to figure out how to create a solution when it comes to restaurants and companies that are Black owned that are being knocked out because of COVID issues. And so those are kind of the perspectives that we have. And one of the things I found, I always like to give actions in two ways. I like a personal action, and then I like a, if we're talking about systemic, then you have to do something to a system. And so you can't just do a personal action, go home and hang out. So the personal action, honestly, my personal action is still evolving. Right now, one of my personal actions has been to try and put people in connection with other people. And what I mean by that, because that sounds real broad, is one of the things I think is a major problem when you talk about systemic racism in financial services is you're dealing with a lot of relationships and you're dealing with somebody who can kind of move your process along this financial path, whether it's getting a loan or whether it's getting some investment or whether it's figuring out how to get your mortgage situation. You're having a hard time moving it, somebody who understands the problems, the obstacles, and moving it along. So it's trying to connect people who understand to people who don't, and also trying to connect people who are unaware to people who are, so that they can become more unaware of how they can do something in their personal sphere as well. From a systemic side, I've actually sat down after doing these and after reading some books and studying and just thinking on it. And I've actually started to write out, I don't know if it's a nonprofit, I don't know if it's a public policy, I don't know what it is just yet. And the biggest dream of things, I think I'd actually like to see it played out through either a local or a federal policy type of approach.
So like a lobbyist organization?
So no, not even an organization, just a flat out bill. Just, just a flat out bill to enact. And I've started to kind of play around with how I see it structured in my mind, in which case that I'm going to actually. So I've already started to write out these scales of it. And then I'm starting to look at how it would really look logistically. And then I'm actually going to, after I finish that process, I'm actually probably, actually is the right word, going to call about a group of about 10 or so people and say, review this. Is this realistic? Like, is this something that can actually be done somewhere, either funded through a nonprofit or funded through a government policy? Is this something that can be done somewhere? And then whatever they come back with is probably going to be how I approach trying to actually do something with it. I want to try and see if I can, with great minds other than mine, put into place some policy that in some level helps to provide hopes, specifically in some low-income forgotten areas, that can provide some balance financially to the system that's been put in place.
Well, that sounds fascinating. Like, and that's like something where a lot of, I've talked to a few other people in this industry that we're in now, the building a podcast, where it's like a certain point where we talk about these issues and we keep talking about these issues, like hoping someone will do something. And at a certain point, we have to be like, oh, that person's me. Okay. No one else is doing it. I have to do it. It is very interesting, like how that you're getting this together and organized. And it sounds like you're creating a lobbyist network. That's what it sounds like.
Yeah, it might end up going that way. I hate the term lobby. Well, but I did it in high school, so I understand there are good and bad sides to it. It's just, for me, it's a negative component. But once again, it's one of those things where if that ends up being what it needs to be in order to create the change, it needs to be the change, then forget it. It's a lobbying group.
Well, I feel like bad for lobbyists, though, because lobbyists seem to get, like, this is a whole other podcast, seems like they kind of get this bad. I look at them as lawyers.
Yeah.
There's good ones and there's bad ones. Like, and that's the lobbyist. But, like, for some reason, they always get hit with being the bad ones.
Like, I know several of them and they're good people, but it's just that word lobbying.
It's a weird concept that you have to have it. I've gone on other podcasts about, like, the strange negative sides of lobbyists and, like, how they're a necessary evil.
Yeah, they are.
And it's like artistic because of a lot of different reasons, going back to finances, because everything comes down to the dollar. But it's a very strange part of our politics that, like, everyone knows about it.
Yeah.
But we kind of walk past them and, like, ignore them.
Yeah, don't look in the window.
Yeah, it's just. But I did want to thank you. I think I'm going to end the podcast right here. I did want to thank you. And for anyone listening, here's podcast is called Open Windows Culture with J. Kevin Powell. I will definitely have you added on there. I hope everyone enjoyed this podcast. If you did, please think about supporting us. We have a Patreon page at Rights and Wrongs Pod. You can also donate on the website or buy some cool merch such as hats, gloves, cups, like sitting over here. And that's at rightsandwrongspodcast.com. If you liked what you heard or you have an issue with it and you want to be heard yourself, feel free to email me at rightsandwrongspodcast@gmail.com. We have both articles that are written by people like you, because I don't want my voice there because you hear me every week. So this is a place for you, the listener, to be heard. Or contact me about being on the podcast. We'd love to hear you, even if you want to go after me for something that I said 4 months ago. But other than that, I hope you have a great day, and thank you for listening to the Rights and Wrongs podcast. And I thank you again, Kevin, for joining us.
Thank you very much.